Hey guys, Nadia Raymond here. If you haven't yet, you really, really need to check out NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how gyms trick us into not showing up. Plus useful stuff like how to steal a million barrels of oil. You know you want to know the answer to that one. Get Planet Money at npr.org/podcasts or on the NPR One app.
This is the StoryCorps podcast. I'm Michael Garofalo, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about a road trip that has lasted for 10 years. I'm going home, and when I want to go home, I'm going mobile. It's the StoryCorps Mobile Tour, which was launched in the late spring of 2005. What we did was we took these Airstream trailers and converted them into mobile recording studios. Now, if you don't know what an Airstream is, they're these RVs. They look like sleek aluminum bullets. They're all curves and smooth corners. They're beautiful. They're these icons of American design. And they really haven't changed much in terms of the way they look since they were introduced in the 1930s. And here's a fun fact. The astronauts from Apollo 11, after returning from the moon, were quarantined in an Airstream. And NASA has used a special modified one called the Astrovan to transport astronauts to the launch pad for many, many years. So these things have deep American roots, and it made sense for us, a project that was going to go out and record any American who wanted to talk all across the country. So what we did was in 2005, we sent these two modified Airstream trailers out into the world. One booth traveling east of the Mississippi and the other west of the Mississippi. Since then, we've stopped in nearly 200 cities, recorded more than 20,000 interviews, and traveled so many miles that we could have circled the Earth three times. These are big numbers, but in this episode, we're going to zero in on just one year, the first year. What were people talking about then, 10 years ago, when they came into StoryCorps? Let's start in Sarasota, Florida. That's where James Ransom and his cousin, Sherry Johnson, recorded their StoryCorps interview. And they remembered the time that they spent at their grandparents' house in Bradenton, Florida, when they were kids. The whole extended family would gather there on weekends and holidays. And for the kids, these visits included Sunday school at the local Methodist church. And what you're going to hear now is James and Sherry remembering their neighbor and Sunday school teacher, Miss Devine. She taught and took care of two generations of their family.
Let's talk about Miss Devine.
Lizzie Devine.
Miss Devine was a wiry lady. She wore summer dresses. She had a bandana and a straw hat. And she was the only person I knew that had more power than my grandmother.
She wasn't a mean person. She was stern.
Stern, yes, very
and you
stern.
Know, when she said something, she meant exactly what she said.
Right.
In fact, she was our Sunday school teacher. The only thing that would keep you from going to Sunday school, you had to have one foot on banana peel and the other in the grave.
Absolutely.
That's the only
There's
thing.
There's no excuse.
You had to go.
Had to go.
One of the things that you prayed for when you were in Ms. Devine's class was, Lord, please let me get old enough to get out of this class. She did the catechism. Who made you? God. Where is God? Everywhere. She went through and said, oh, Lord, have mercy, please.
This Ms. Devine would come in on Sunday mornings to take us to Sunday school. And when I saw her come, Sherry, I thought the leaves would be blowing out the trees and the sky would go black and the clouds would come in. And she'd come in the house one morning and say, good morning, children. And everybody, my mother on down, said, good morning, Miss Devine. And she says, it's time to go to Sunday school this morning, children. I said, Miss Devine, I can't go to Sunday school today. She said, no. I said, no, ma'am. She says, why not? She said, because I said, my mother didn't bring enough clothes for me to go to Sunday school this morning. She said, oh, no. I said, no, ma'am. She said, well, what do you have? What kind of clothes do you have? I said, all I have, Mr. Vine, are my pajamas and my tennis shoes. She said, well, that's okay, honey. Put your tennis shoes on. We go to Sunday school. I looked at my mother, and she looked away, Sherry. Mr. Vine made me walk 2 blocks in my pajamas and my tennis shoes. I had to sit in church with my friends. Doing Sunday school, my pajamas and my tennis shoes. I'm going to tell you, Sherry, I'll never lie again.
Ms. Devine was always there to take care of us.
Right.
But when Ms. Devine braided your hair, your eyes went up like this. You had to sleep on soft pillows because, I mean, boy, she had it tight. And Ms. Divine had mango trees all over her yard. But Ms. Divine never brought you a mango until it was rotten. It would smell like liquor. That's when she brought you a mango.
But you know what? That's the kind of stuff that we got growing up. And I'll never forget that.
That was James Ransom with his cousin Sherry Johnson in Sarasota, Florida. For our next stop, let's head to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. One thing we did hear a lot on the first year of the tour was people sort of remembering industries that were gone or ways of life that had started to disappear. And this next story is an example of that. It comes from Ken Kobus, and three generations of his family worked in a steel mill near Pittsburgh. By the time he recorded his interview, the steel mill was gone. But Ken still had memories from his childhood about his father, John, who spent a lifetime making steel.
The mill was always in my life, even as a baby. I mean, I always heard and smelled the mill, and it was just ever-present. My father, he worked there for most of his life. His nickname was Crow. They called him Crow. He was what they call a first helper. That was a man that was in charge of one furnace in the plant. And the first time I went into the shop, I just remember it like yesterday. So there were all these things moving back and forth, and I was afraid I was going to get run over. And my dad just walked straight through like nothing was going on. You know, it's just amazing. And to face a furnace is just, it's hard to describe, because you watch cold steel being put into there and watch it become more and more red and red and red, and then it disappears and falls apart, and it's just unimaginable. I know that it stuck with my father for all his life. I mean, when he was dying, he had cancer. We had him in hospice, and he was in a lot of pain, so they're giving him lots of morphine. And I was watching him in a bed once, and the doctor came in, and my dad was laying on his back, and he like was had his hands up in the air, and he was turning and manipulating, and the doctor saw that I was looking at my dad, and he says, we're wondering what the heck he's doing. Because, you know, he did it all the time. He would be laying on his back, and he would be doing this stuff, and they had no clue as to what he was doing. And I said, oh, he says, I could tell you, he's making steel. He was opening furnace doors, and he was adjusting the gas on the furnace and the draft. I could see what he was doing. And the doctor was amazed, you know. And to the day he died, that's how he lived. He lived steelmaking.
That's Ken Kobus remembering his father, John, who worked in steel mills his entire life. And Ken told that story to his friend Ron Baroff at the StoryCorps mobile booth in Pittsburgh. Let's head south now to Jackson, Mississippi, where we'll hear the story of Willie Earl Dow. His nickname was Pip. Now, Willie Earl was a guy who was in trouble with the law a lot, and his misadventures put him in front of the same judge over and over again. That judge was named Joe Pigott, and he served nearly two decades on the bench in Jackson. But no defendant made a bigger impression on him than the man they called Pip.
Many of the people who came before me were not educated, but they were certainly intelligent. Some of them, you dealt with them several times, and the one that comes to mind most was Willie Earl Pip Dow. He would take what was not his in order to finance his drinking problem. You didn't have to try him. He always pled guilty, and he was a likable person. He would write me letters, and he wrote me one time, and he said, Judge, I feel like I've been up here long enough this time, and I would appreciate if you'd write the parole board and see if they'll let me out. Well, I did, and they did. and he had been out maybe 6 weeks when he began drinking and took his friend's watch and the keys to his friend's car. And his friend called the sheriff and told him that he'd been robbed by Willie Earl. But he knew exactly where Willie was, and so the sheriff went there and got him and locked him up. And when he came up before me, of course, he pled guilty again, and I got ready to sentence him. "Come around, Mr. Dow. I am so disappointed I don't know what to say. I have given you another chance, and then you got in trouble again, and I just don't understand you." Well, he said, "Well, Judge, I'm disappointed in you." Everything in the courtroom got deathly quiet. He said, "When I was here 4 years ago, you were sitting in that same chair, wearing that same robe, making that same speech. I figured a man of your caliber ought to at least be on the Supreme Court by now." "Well," I told him, "Mr. Dow, I was going to sentence you to 5 years, but since you are so perceptive, I think I'll just give you 3 years, which I did. Well, later, when I retired, they had a little ceremony there in the courtroom to hang my portrait. And in walks Willie Earl Pip Dow. And I told him, "Mr. Dow, I am so glad to see you." He said, "Well, I heard they were going to hang Judge Pigott at the courtroom, and so I didn't want to miss that." I said, "Well, I'm resigning. How long is it going to be before you going back to the penitentiary?" He said, "Judge, you resigning? I'm resigning. I'm a retired just like you." Well, I asked the judge that replaced me and the sheriff of the county to let me know if he got arrested for anything after that, and he did not. He lived about 10 more years and died a couple of years ago, but he was such a likable person. Sometimes you make friends in strange ways.
That was Judge Joe Pigott remembering Willie Earl Pip Dow with his wife Lorraine in Jackson, Mississippi. Next, we're going to travel to Texas and hear from another lawman, but of a different sort. His name is Rick Kincaid, and he spent 11 years as a bounty hunter. He came to the StoryCorps booth in Austin, Texas, with his friend, Danny Ray Terry.
How many folks do you figure that you picked up?
There's probably 300 or 400 people that I've chased down and locked up. Most of what bounty hunting is about is just a matter of finding them. They don't want to go, but once they get caught, they usually... pretty easy to get along with. We built up a good reputation as some real hard-nosed bounty hunters. Some fellas would find out we were chasing them, they'd just go put theirself in jail. Probably one of the more funnier bounty hunts that I ever did, that wasn't a very high-paying job. It became a matter of principle to catch this young feller. He really wasn't in all that much trouble, and I would think I was only getting about $300 to pick him up, but every time we'd go to his house, he'd take off out that back door and hit them woods, and we just couldn't catch him. After 3 or 4 times of going out to this young man's house to pick him up, and he always ran on us, we decided one night we were going to get him. So we went to Walmart and bought some cup hooks and went over by my uncle's house and picked up an old net, and we strapped that thing around the front porch of his house and beat on the back door, and he took off out the front and got tangled up in that net, and we got him in jail about 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, we had
One of the easiest catches you've had, huh?
Probably so, yes, sir.
What about one of the toughest cases you had? What would you have to say that was?
I was on a $100,000 jump bond, and when we started chasing the old boy, it was aggravated kidnapping. However, once we got the job and signed the contract to find him, we come to find out that he was a big-time methamphetamine drug dealer. So we figured out that then that we were up against a little bit more than what we had originally bargained for. And actually, the night that we got him, the sheriff's department was supposed to hit the house about the same time I did. I went in first, and unknownst to me, they were about 10 minutes behind me. We didn't know that that was a drug lab, and I walked right in the middle of it, and they took me down and began to beat me pretty good. They broke my jaw and knocked out a couple of my teeth with some old pliers, and then they began to pull the teeth out as I wouldn't answer questions. Of course, I really couldn't answer the questions. I was in too much pain. So I was sure proud to see when the sheriff's department finally did break in there and get me out of that. And that was the night I retired from bounty hunting. I walked down the road to where my wife was sitting in a van and told her that that was about as close to death as I wanted to get.
That's retired bounty hunter Rick Kincaid with his friend Danny Ray Terry in Austin, Texas. Our last story is between a mother and daughter from Los Angeles. Their names are Blanca and Connie Alvarez, and in their interview, Blanca remembered coming to Los Angeles more than 30 years ago. She came to join her husband, who is already here, and what you're about to listen to is the story of how she crossed the border.
We were walking and walking through the mountains.
In the desert?
Uh-huh. And the man, he told us to take our shoes off because it was a lot of rocks. And he said, I don't want no noise because the dogs are very, very good to detect every noise. Oh. And he said, I'm going to whistle and you're going to duck. And it was a point where he whistled. You know, we went out on our stomachs and we stayed there. Oh, my God, I can see ants, big ants crawling. And I was so scared. And he said, when the Border Patrol changed shifts,
yes,
you know, you're going to run.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was a torture in those rocks with our shoes. So we ran as fast as we could. And then he said, you're going to walk through that bridge. I'm going to walk behind you and you're going to give me the money there. And then from there, you're on your own.
What kinds of jobs did you have since first arriving in the country?
We were gardeners, and we were cleaning offices.
I remember the offices.
You remember that? We had the night shift cleaning. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, we had to take you and your brother. I didn't have a babysitter.
I have memories of running into everyone's office and eating candy from their candy dishes. I remember being with my brother in our pajamas with the little plastic feet. And I also remember you would always buy us a cup of noodle from the vending machine,
right.
Like a snack, and then put us to bed on people's office couches. And then you'd carry us to the car when you guys were done cleaning the offices. Right. I remember that. Did they ever know? Did your bosses ever know that you took your kids?
No, I don't think so.
Is there anything that you've never told me but want to tell me now?
When we first came here, we went through a lot of things like not eating.
Hmm.
I guess for 6 months, your father lost his job, and but we never told you that.
I do remember a lot of bean tacos.
But when you ask us why the same thing, remember?
Yeah.
I didn't want to tell you why.
Yeah. If you could do everything again, would you raise me differently?
I would dedicate more time, I guess. You know, I was so busy going to school, too, that I guess I neglected you a little bit.
No, for me, watching you go to school with two kids and trying to make ends meet, that was the biggest inspiration for me to finish college. I thought there's nothing that could stand in my way that didn't stand in yours more. So it's the most important thing for me, having gone to college, and I feel like anything I do from here on out is okay because I've already achieved my dream. Everything else is icing on the cake.
Connie Alvarez with her mother Blanca at StoryCorps in Los Angeles. Connie talked about going to college in the piece. She graduated from UCLA. Thanks for traveling cross-country with me on this special episode of the StoryCorps podcast. After 10 years, StoryCorps is still on the road. We're actually in Colorado Springs right now until June 19th. Then we move on to Vernal, Utah, Seattle, Washington, Sacramento, California, LA again, and then we end the year in Tucson. Now, we have to give a shout out to all the public radio stations we've partnered with over the years. There have been hundreds and hundreds of them, and they've been the most incredible hosts. I said at the top of the podcast that we've recorded 20,000 interviews. Well, we couldn't have done it without these public radio stations. They are the heart and soul of public radio in this country. And the other people that deserve a huge thank you are the facilitators who work on the mobile booths. This is probably the best job in the world. They get to go out for months at a time and just listen to people tell their stories. But the truth is, it's really, really hard work. They live out of a suitcase. They don't see their friends or family for months at a time. These are incredibly hardworking, incredibly curious, incredibly compassionate people who care a lot about StoryCorps and about the work that they do. There's way too many to name here, but if you're listening and you've worked on the StoryCorps mobile tour, thank you. And one final shout out to the team who launched the mobile tour 10 years ago. Matt Ozug, Eliza Bettinger, Zach Barr, Kayvon Bahramian, Brett Myers, Nora Levine, Laura Spiro, and Anna Goldman. For the StoryCorps podcast, I'm Michael Garofalo. Until next time, thanks for listening. Every day I get you. Magic bus. To get on the bus that takes me to you. Bus, magic bus. I'm so nervous I just sit and smile. Magic bus. The house is only another mile. Bus, magic bus. Thank you, Java, for getting me. Hey, it's me, Nadia Raymond, again, reminding you to check out another great podcast, NPR's Planet Money. Get it at npr.org/podcasts or on the NPR One app.